Hello, I'm Mark Davis, a barrister at Six Pump Court.
And I'm Simone Davidson, head of the PSL Environment Team at LexisNexis and a trustee and vice chair of the UK Environmental Law Association.
Now, we've made a change to the usual format of the Environment Law News podcast to partner up with you, Kayla, and bring you a COVID-19 special.
Yeah, and in this podcast, we're fortunate to be hearing from Peter Kellett, Director of Legal Services for the Environment Agency, Richard Broadbent, Principal Solicitor for Natural England, and Terry Ahern, CEO of the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, on what their organisations are doing in light of the COVID-19 virus.
Absolutely. And as with everything in the pandemic, the landscape has changed quickly. So things may have moved on by the time this goes out. And also, you'll have to please accept our apologies for any issues in relation to sound quality. Like everyone else, we've been working from home in producing this. So first up, we have Peter Kellett. Thank you for taking the time to join us, Peter. And I wonder if, to start with, you could try and explain what the main challenges for environmental regulators and operators have been during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for the chance to speak to the environmental legal community. We'll get through this period calmly and by acting proportionately. My thoughts are with the many people who've lost loved ones early in the pandemic. We at the Environment Agency are always focused on protecting lives and livelihoods and the environment, and our commitment to this is unchanged. But we have to take account of the national situation and the social distancing instructions. We've of course focused on the health, safety and well-being of our staff. We're fully operational and we've needed to prioritise our work to maintain critical services. Three of these, as a Category 1 responder under the Civil Contingencies Act, responding 24/7 to flooding and environmental incidents. For example, we're working with local partners to ensure that the additional clinical waste is safely disposed of. Warning about flood risk, maintaining existing building new flood structures, the Boston flood barrier that's going to protect 17,000 properties, and regulating potentially the most hazardous sites, refineries, nuclear power stations. We thought carefully about the main risks to delivery, the impacts on those we regulate, and the wider risks to the country. We carry on regulating business, farming, water, waste, energy, and we also manage some of the wider areas that people would have concerns around. We've had to be really agile, and this has been a really uncertain period, and the risks keep evolving. We've also tried to support our supply chain. So rather than strictly enforce our legal rights, we wanted to be in a position where we had a robust supply chain at the end of this period. Dealing with a major incident is in our DNA as an emergency responder, from floods to droughts. But it's not been easy because the added complications of social distancing and caring responsibilities make this pandemic particularly challenging. Most organisations will have experienced similar rapid changes to their operating models, and we at the Environment Agency have had to pivot and stabilise a delivery model where we've moved staff out of offices to home-based working. We've had exactly the same challenge though with field teams, and their work is essential. So we've found ways of working where they reduce the risk of contracting coronavirus. We've prioritised the high-risk assets and activities. We're using social distancing. We're working as flexibly as we can to reduce the number of face-to-face interactions of team members. We're taking protective measures to safeguard kit, vehicles out of the environment. And we're also ensuring our contractors are aware and follow the correct procedures. And I'm really proud of the way we've worked with local and national partners, helping the emergency services, local councils in the 38 resilience fora we have across the country, because they're coordinating the effects to help the vulnerable.
Thank you, Peter. That does really sound challenging. And of course, many organisations have been facing similar pressures in terms of working out how to keep their staff safe, observe social distancing, but also in terms of carrying out their operations. Thinking a bit more about the Environment Agency and how it carries out its work, or at least one aspect of its work, have you found alternative ways to ensure that companies comply with environmental permits?
Yes, I mean, we've found alternative ways to secure compliance with environmental laws and not just permits. We've had to be really creative because respecting social distancing is tricky. I mean, for example, waste transfer notes are predominantly electronic now. but there are still 6 million paper notes every year. So paper transfers between people. And we found a way to avoid unnecessary physical contact through paper. And I think that's been a really good learning experience. We've also found that we recognise the difficulties that businesses face as a result of coronavirus, and we've had to take account of the national situation. We do expect businesses to use contingency plans to help them comply with requirements and minimise unavoidable non-compliance. Our commitment to protecting people and the environment doesn't change whilst dealing with the effects of coronavirus. And permitting and permit conditions aren't just about inspections, but there are monitoring conditions to air and water. There's environmental monitoring. There are lots of forms of engagement between regulators and the regulated, not just site visits, but advice and guidance, permitting, auditing, analysing data returns, desktop assessments and incident response. And we continue to carry out regulatory visits to sites that could cause serious environmental harm where it's required. But we've also reduced regulatory visits to other sites, continue to review how best we regulate in accordance with government guidance. Now, of course, some people are going to take advantage and exploit the crisis. And we're monitoring this really carefully. Across the country, our teams are still investigating environmental offending, and we're still preparing legal cases. I was looking at some just this morning. We consider the appropriate response to any unavoidable non-compliance, allowing for social distancing and our enforcement and sanctions policy. We continue to work with fellow regulators and with the police. If you suspect illegal activity, please continue to report it immediately to us, or if you prefer, anonymously to Crime Stoppers 0800 555 111.
Thank you. It will be very interesting to see if any of the changes that have come into force, you know, like paper waste transfer notes, actually are here to stay afterwards, but we'll have to wait and see on that. And you mentioned government guidance, but are there any other areas that the Environment Agency has published guidance or position statements on regarding how operators should comply during the pandemic?
Yes, I mean, thanks. We've communicated directly with organisations we regulate, with trade bodies and with other public authorities. And we've adopted and published generic guidance on gov.uk, but also a series of regulatory position statements. And in adopting these, we had to think really carefully about being sure that non-compliance is unavoidable due to coronavirus, minimising the scope for crime and abuse, minimising the risk to harm and to human health, and fixing them with time limits. Now, these position statements agree of extra flexibility while ensuring that standards are maintained to protect people in the environment. As of last night, we'd adopted 13 positions covering a range of areas from milk and slurry to waste to water regulation. So, for example, we've adopted a position that allows healthcare workers visiting infected homes to double bag their PPE, wait 72 hours and put it into the domestic waste stream, because the alternative is they carry it back to their premises in their van. The handling risks increase for them and for the NHS, and so for all of them. So we think for this period, it's a good position to adopt.
Thank you for explaining that, Peter. I think those regulatory position statements and the other guidance that's been mentioned already are no doubt going to be pored over by the operators and their advisors alike as they try to navigate compliance during the pandemic. But just thinking about post-pandemic, what do you think the legacy of COVID-19 will be in terms of how the Environment Agency carries out its operations, and as well as more generally for the environment?
I think there'll be lots of changes. It's likely there's going to be more home working, but it's not for everybody and it doesn't work for everybody. Some people like to be in teams in offices. There will be more innovative team working. I think we'll be using some screen-based applications to help regulate sites. We're exploring drones and photographic evidence to check compliance. And we're undertaking remote audits. More broadly, I'd hope that we can use this opportunity of different ways of working to decarbonize our supply chain. And we hope that we'll be able to achieve our 2025 net zero target. And more wise, I hope that I share my hopes for a green recovery.
Thank you. And finally, is there anything that environmental lawyers should be thinking about to assist the Environment Agency?
Yes, three things, please. First, serve documents on us by email during the social distancing period, because we can't really rely on the post. Second, speak to us early before online court hearings, because we, you and the courts may be working with different social media platforms, and experience shows it's really helpful to have that conversation before. And thirdly, and more broadly, just a reflection, the Honourable Justice Brian Preston spoke recently about the possibilities of conscious lawyering at UCL. And that reminded me of our professional obligations to uphold the rule of law, including how we support and encourage compliance with environmental law. And I hope environmental lawyers will keep this in mind as we begin to restart the economy in the weeks and months ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter. That absolutely makes perfect sense. I think we're going to wrap things up there. Thank you so much for your time and for giving us such useful information on how the EA is responding to COVID-19. So next up, we have Richard Broadbent. Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. Perhaps you could begin by discussing what you feel the main challenges are for regulators during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I mean, for us in Natural England, where so much of our work is on site, it's getting out on site, doing things like enforcement work, field work, surveying, monitoring, evidence collection, all of that. Since lockdown started, our policy is that our staff don't go out on site unless there are exceptional circumstances. And I guess we can talk about those a bit later on. But that's been the thing, and there's missing those opportunities about enhancing and restoring the natural environment, in particular, and the advice that we give to land managers and developers and so on around that.
Oh, interesting. So I appreciate that people currently aren't going out onto site routinely, but for those that are, how are site visits and site inspections being dealt with?
Well, I mean, they have to be complying with government guidance on social distancing and so on, but really there are very few visits going on. One of the dilemmas that we face is if we do allow people out at this time. I'm hoping that as we have a phased return back to normality, that will start easing up, but I can't imagine social distancing and that sort of stuff will finish anytime soon.
Thank you, that's really helpful to know. Just wondering what the approach is for how wildlife offences are being tracked during lockdown.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we have our own internal incident tracker, which is recording that. And that relies on things that our staff are aware of, but also incidents that have come to us from the public or from the police. And we have seen an uptick in activity on that, which is slightly above normal levels, particularly more incidents of arson. And maybe that was because of the dry weather as well, and fly tipping, particularly in rural areas. Interestingly, also talking to colleagues just today, we've had 20 tip-offs in the last month. On offences under the EIA agriculture regulations. So that's where fields are ploughed up, which are uncultivated or contain semi-natural habitat. This time last year, we had 4 tip-offs. We have 20 this year. Now, that might be because people are staying put and they're taking an interest in what's going on around them. You know, that maybe that's part of it. Or maybe there is more activity beyond the norm. We're just too early into this to have a sense of a trend on that. But that's interesting. So we are recording those things. And of course, as they come in, you know, we wouldn't need to do a site visit to start investigating those sorts of incidents, those sorts of tip-offs. So we are already working on those and processing them.
So it's clearly creating some further challenges for you. So has it caused you to have to prioritise certain work areas, and if so, how do you make the calls as to which areas you do prioritise?
Well, yeah, absolutely right. I think all government departments at the moment are and arm's length bodies are looking at where to prioritise work and what you know, categories to use for that and so on. I would say that with the legal work and the enforcement work, those remain high category, you know, category one type activities for us. And what we'll continue to do is assess incidents as they occur on a case-by-case basis. I've seen the EA produce regulatory position statements, which makes sense because they have different sectors which and different bits of legislation, so that makes sense. But for us, as a lot of wildlife offences turn on the circumstances, you know, the specific nature of those cases, then we'll look at each one against our compliance enforcement guidance, you know, and then consider how urgent it is in light of that. And of course, the more urgent ones where you're trying to stop, you know, harm from happening, you know, serving stop notices, well, then we'll need to get on with that. But there might be less urgent action where we can, you know, take longer maybe to take action on those, taking into account, you know, the time limits for offences.
Thank you. That's going to be that guidance is going to be really useful and probably of interest to stakeholders at this time. Just thinking about looking forward a bit more, what do you think the legacy of COVID-19 will be for how you carry out your operations?
Oh, certainly a better use of technology, and working with our partners more on that. So, for example, the we have an Earth observation team that's using information from a variety of different sources, you know, mapping, satellite images, and so on. We're not allowed to fly our drones at the moment, but you know, we can collect data from other sources. So using tech in that sort of way, stronger partnerships with other regulators, particularly the police, working with the police on wildlife crimes, you know, pooling, you know, sharing intelligence and pooling resources. I think we've learned a bit about that. We're already doing things like that, but this has given a real, you know, impetus to looking into that creatively. And I think that trend will continue.
Well, that's good to hear. And it's good to hear that data is being used. Certainly some of the data that already exists show that there are actually been some quite significant benefits to the environment from the lockdown. And those have been quite widely reported. Do you have any plans to try and build on those gains at all?
Yeah, so there has been less pollution as a result of, you know, fewer trips and so on, and that's good. But these are exceptional circumstances. You know, this is an abnormal time. People are acting in a very artificial way at the moment, and you know, our environment in this country is one that requires a lot of management and cultivation by people and involvement by people in it. And of course, some of that work isn't going ahead at the moment. Some of it is, but some of it's being restricted. And, you know, that's not necessarily a beneficial thing for the environment. Also, you know, giving people access to the natural environment as well, I think is really important. And there's been a lack of that, you know, national parks closed, even, you know, parks and cities closed. And that's not a good trend. You know, if we want people to better connect with the natural environment, well, they need access to it. They need to be part of it, integrate themselves within it and into their thinking about how we go about our daily lives. So I'd hope that, you know, we, you know, the legacy of this is thinking of ways where we can be more integrated in the natural environment rather than trying to avoid it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so true. And I think many people are discovering or rediscovering the importance of nature for mind, body and soul at the moment.
Absolutely right.
In respect of the environment, from the point of view of the regulator, what would you like people to take away from the lockdown?
So, you know, if you're aware of, I think if people have stayed in one location for a long period of time now, they're taking a real interest in what's going on around them, you know, in their gardens and in the surrounding environment. You know, and if people are aware of wildlife offences, then let us know. I mean, we've seen an uptick in tip-offs. So, you know, that's helpful to us. We can't police the natural environment very well. And we are reliant on people providing us with that information, and that's useful. But now, more than that, I you know, take this as an opportunity to try to, you know, experience your local environment, enjoy it, you know, see what you can personally do within it to improve it. You know, when the Environment Bill comes along, there's a whole array of new laws in there, you know, new policies, which are about trying to connect people with nature, you know, local nature recovery networks. See how you can feed into that, I think, is really important. I think the other thing about this is that it's highlighted the inequality also of people's access to the natural environment. And I think that's going to be a real legacy of this. You know, in the 25-year plan, there's a horrible statistic in there that says 12% of children don't visit that natural environment each year. That's shocking. And I think the people's experience of, you know, being contained in one location will really flag that up. And, you know, being in the natural environment is so important to your mental health, to your well-being. And I really hope that the post-COVID economic recovery that happens thinks about that. You know, businesses think about, okay, how you know, do my workforce have access to local green spaces? Because actually my workforce benefits in terms of their well-being from having that access. You know, I'd rather that be a something that we take away from this.
Yeah, it's very refreshing to hear you say that. But you mentioned the 25-year environment plan. What impact do you think COVID-19 has had on that, or indeed on the bill?
We know that the bill isn't advancing through Parliament. I hope that they're looking at ways to use tech to open up Parliament a bit more and you know, get things moving again. I don't know whether the Environment Bill is high up in the list of priorities. I can only assume there will be a delay. And the longer this sort of restriction goes on, the greater that delay, I would imagine. But my view on the Environment Bill, and I think it's something that, you know, Natural England has worked closely on for a number of years now. And what I like about it is that environmental law and regulation has, for the last 30, 40 years, been quite a top-down led affair, you know, setting standards, designating certain protected sites, and that's, you know, in certain species and so on. And that's good. That's important. You know, that was needed. But this is actually slightly different. This is more of a sort of grassroots up form of environmental regulation. And what I mean by that is, you know, new tools like conservation covenants, where people can make their own choices as to what areas should be protected in perpetuity. You know, getting involved in these nature recovery networks, you know, local areas planning to conserve nature, you know, protecting habitats as part of this wider national nature recovery network. Well, that's good, you know, and, you know, there's a real opportunity for people to see how decisions are made locally and get involved, involved in that. The net gain work as well. Well, you know, if a housing development is going in and you're losing a green space from that, well, what's the net gain you're getting from that? You know, people taking interest in that through this kind of experience. Well, I hope that happens. And I think actually the timing of the Environment Bill might be quite good coming in the wake of this. I hope that's how people receive it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think all the time that people have had, those of us that have had access to nature, it's been great. And it's the sort of thing that will foster kind of that sense of ownership that you need to build sort of action so that people want to take part in conservation and to build on these policies that do promote conservation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us, Richard. I'm afraid that is all we have time for today. So thank you so much. And again, thank you for everything you've said. It's been really very helpful and very instructive.
Thanks for inviting me.
And finally, we hear from Terry Ahern. Terry, thanks so much for joining us today. Can we start by asking you what the biggest challenge has been for SEPA during this pandemic?
As with most employers, the first challenge is how do you get a workforce from offices and laboratories and out in the field to working from home very quickly, which I was actually in Australia on holiday visiting family that first 3 weeks, and I was quite impressed with how the organisation did that. So when I got back, still lots to do, and we still have some logistical work to do, but that big challenge of moving, in our case, just over 1,200 people to work from home was done really well in that first period. Then coming to doing that, it's okay, well, how do you do the bulk of your work from home? So how do you carry out checking on compliance, monitoring the environment, et cetera, et cetera. So they're the key challenges, and they're not a surprise. I think what we're finding is, like all crises, you put yourself in a crisis position and you find ways to get a lot done that you probably could have been doing in the first place. So, yeah, the key challenges are, one, how do you get the workforce to this completely new way of working, get them just physically, get them home and set up, and then how do you do all the things that you need to do in a different way, because most of what we need to do needs to be done differently.
So with all of those workers at home and thinking about compliance, if you aren't able to get to operators, how are site visits and inspections being dealt with?
So I'll be a bit cautious about what I'll say, because for those businesses that are keen to comply with the law, I can be very open. For those that might want to do the opposite, I need to I can generally describe what we're doing, but I obviously don't want to give our tactics away too much. It is interesting, because people say, for example, with one of our biggest challenges is the Exxon Shell Moss Morin facility here, which we've had significant problems with flaring over a long period. And some people said, well, you won't be doing many inspections. Well, actually, the inspections of the site are not much of the proportion of what we do. You know, the bulk of what we're doing with them is going through their BAT assessment, talking to them about whether, you know, at the moment, in terms of their improvements, are there supply chain interruptions that are going to affect the upgrades that they had planned? Now, most of that's just discussion anyway with the operator, you know, and a lot of the time it happens at the site because we go out to the site, but it doesn't make any difference to doing it over the phone or by video. Similarly, getting compliance data from companies, I mean, you assess that. You can be sitting at home, you can be sitting in an office, you can be sitting there at the company site talking to people. So it's probably, I think you start from a little bit of a misnomer that being on the site, it is important, but it's not quite as essential. It's not like lots of things fall apart if you can't be physically at the site. There's still quite a bit that we either would have done from our offices, so you can do it from home, or you would have done at site, but it doesn't really depend on being at site. Now, obviously, being on the site is important. So it becomes more important when we have things like if we get odour complaints and we need to be out there checking whether that's significant or not, and we're looking into ways we can do that. We're trying to find other ways of gathering intelligence information. So, again, I'm not going to go into how we're doing that, but there are a variety of sources we can use. And it's probably, I think, like a lot of people be saying at the moment, whatever sector they're in, we're finding things that we have done, like for us working closely with the police and other regulatory or enforcement agencies, we're doing more of that and probably upgrading more quickly stuff we would have liked to have done anyway. So there's those range of things we can do. I think the other thing that's really important is, if you have someone who's really honest and absolutely top-class performer, checking compliance is not particularly onerous. I mean, it doesn't matter how good a business is. You know, they might have a 100% track record for 10 years running. You really trust them. They show you can be trusted. You'll still always be checking. But one of the things is about setting the right expectations for this period. And we were very clear in coming out and saying, we understand that every single business we regulate won't be able to do what they were doing before the pandemic started. So everyone has limitations on their workforce, has disruptions to supply chains. So setting out that we want everyone to make their best endeavours to meet their obligations, to prioritise environmental outcomes over our administrative requirements for this period, I think also helps with compliance, because if the people you regulate find you're being reasonable and helpful, you've got more likelihood that they will comply. And we the feedback we're getting is that's been quite significant.
Thank you. I mean, are there certain areas that you're looking at that you're prioritising? And if there are, how do you decide which areas to prioritise?
Well, we would always have a prioritisation approach anyway. So some things go up a bit more and some things go down a little bit more. So, for example, noise and odour complaints. You have a different lens on these things. So in the scheme of things, when you're heading for 2 or 3 degrees warming, you might say, well, noise and odour, does that really matter? But anyone who's lived with significant noise or odour will tell you that it's terrible. And we've probably all had at least one evening in our life where someone's been playing loud music and we can't sleep. So when you think about that during the lockdown, if we have people in Scotland who are experiencing systemic noise and odour, and to contribute to the public health emergency effort, they have to be at their home. And instead of just experiencing it, for example, if they're a full-time worker, they don't work at home, it's annoying early in the morning or late at night. If they're experiencing it 24 hours a day, on top of those people who are living at home all the time, those issues actually become more significant during the pandemic. So there's a bit of a push for us to say, well, we need to try and solve those during this period. Otherwise, it will potentially undermine the public health effort and the lockdown. The other big issue, or probably the biggest issue for us, is waste and things like fly tipping. So there's a lot of evidence that that's increased significantly, and we're hearing the same from other jurisdictions. Now, things like fly tipping are very difficult in normal times. How do you find someone? Does it really have much effect if you take enforcement action afterwards? You know, it sends a bit of a signal and so on. So once more, I think that's probably, if we looked at what's changed, I think waste and fly tipping, which was already a problem, it is for most EPAs or environment agencies, that's gone up recently.
I should think you're hoping, like many other people, that the tips are reopened soon. But you touched on this earlier. Do you think that the pandemic will leave a legacy for CEPA and how it carries out its operations?
Well, we've set out under our One Planet Prosperity strategy to be a radically different EPA. So we hold a very strong view that we talk about the difference between a phase one and a phase two EPA. And the phase one EPAs were set up when environmental management was get your waste out into the environment as soon as you could. It wasn't poor practice. You know, if you go back 30 or 40 years, if there's a river, that's where your water pollution goes. And in that first phase, the right thing for EPAs and environment agencies to focus on was, how do you stop pollution from factories and other types of facilities? So if you have, I mean, the part of Australia I'm from had the third EPA in the world set up in 1970. That's because it was the manufacturing base. And one of the rivers, the main river, used to regularly catch on fire. Well, you don't sit around having workshops about the circular economy if there's so much pollution going into a river that it's catching on fire. What's happening in your supply chain, and do you think there are any opportunities? It's not what you do. So the right thing in phase one is to try and get gross industrial pollution under control. Now, we still have challenges, but if you make an analogy with the pandemic, if the health systems all around the world were still dealing with people with a broken arm, they reset it, people who need a heart operation, they do that, all the work they normally do, and we're completely ignoring the pandemic, all those individual actions, like my arm set properly, I need that done, but I will have a much higher risk of dying from the coronavirus because we're not dealing with the systemic issues. Now, EPAs were largely set up to deal with site-specific issues. They have contributed to the broader issues by doing that, but what we now need to do is do both. We need to keep dealing with odour noise from facilities, or if they are above the phosphorus discharge, we need to keep fixing them. That's absolutely part of this phase two. We also need to be tackling climate change, making our contribution. We need to help the businesses we regulate decarbonise, dematerialise, use less water through their supply chains. So that's what we were setting out to do anyway. We hope that this period, as awful as it is, can help us accelerate. So we've been talking to businesses about how they cope during this current crisis. And we've also been talking to them about what are the opportunities we come out of it. So the legacy for me needs to be, we continue to get better at dealing with these residual pollution issues at sites, of which there are still many. They're not generally as severe as they were originally. And we also become much, much better at systemic work. So if I go back to the question about waste, I mean, you look at one of the reasons most first world countries have problems with waste. Partly it's the economics of the sector and it's the pricing model. So you don't pay an architect and a builder before they've designed and built your renovation. you pay them in stages. What we do in waste is we give people all the money and then all the costs of compliance come after they've got the revenue. So no wonder there's an incentive for, say, organised crime to get in. So I think as EPAs, that legacy of in a crisis, you get better at lots of things or you collapse and don't cope. So how do we get better at the site stuff and how do we get better at the systemic solutions? We won't solve fly tipping by being more effective at putting fines on. We need to put more fines on, absolutely. We need to get better at enforcement. That's why we've set up an enforcement unit for the first time ever, a dedicated team. And we need to find the systemic solutions to the problems in the economic system that are creating the pollution incident or the environmental problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've heard quite a lot about the benefits to the environment from the lockdown. There's been all talk about, you know, there's been much less air pollution. There's been wildlife returning to places where it hasn't been seen for a while. I guess from what you've been saying, it does sound like you all have plans to try and build on those gains, do you?
Yeah, that's what we're starting to do. So in our annual operating plan, which I got back from Australia and we got the board to approve it my second day back. And of course, it had been completely developed before the pandemic and the lockdown. And I'd been back about a week and I said, we need to rewrite this. Now, a lot of it's the same, but we did a very simple thing. We divided the year into a 6-month emergency period and a 6-month recovery or renewal period. Now, of course, it won't work like that at all. That's a completely arbitrary division. And there are already things that are going on that are recovery or renewal based around the country. And no doubt in March next year, in the last month of the financial year, there'll still be some emergency things happening and maybe beyond that. But it gave us a frame of thinking about what's more emergency related, what's more recovery related, and how do we bring the two types of thinking together so we can think about how we make improvements, how we entrench the things that have gone well, work out what hasn't gone well, and perhaps correct those more quickly. So that sort of is the approach we've taken on that issue.
That's very, very interesting. Is there anything, you know, in respect to the environment from the point of view as you as the regulator that you would like people to take away from lockdown, you know, perhaps about how they view the environment or how they might enjoy it, perhaps?
I think there's a few things, how people enjoy it. So my wife and I go for our daily walk and we talk about how the normal vista we have, we say, gee, the water's actually blue. Now we're looking at it, you know, a couple of miles away and saying, those trees on the other side on the hills, they're green. Because with the air pollution in a major city, you can't actually see it that clearly. So yes, we would like people to retain and more highly value the benefits of the environment. And this is, you know, I'm in a very, very much an urban environment, we're in a city. But in addition to that, this tension we now have between economic recession or depression and tackling the pandemic, I've always got this strong view that if you start with the idea you need to trade two things off, the best you will achieve is some trade-off. So how do you achieve both? And this has been one of the big challenges in the environment movement since it started, that if you think of... well, I'm not really saying anything particularly political. Obviously, President Trump thinks if you do something to the environment, you potentially damage the economy and the other way around. And his view, he says this very publicly, is that the economy to some degree should take the priority. We have a big challenge in that here at coming out of a pandemic. You know, how do you get enough of the economy going? But the more we can push our minds to say, well, we really enjoy the environment. We've really enjoyed having less air pollution. We're seeing, you know, people are always putting on Twitter or LinkedIn, you know, there's an otter here. We haven't seen otters here for 10 years in this part of the river, et cetera. Do we have to make these trade-offs? Are there ways of getting the economy going with lower environmental impact and then perpetuating an economy that has lower environmental impact? If you think about, I mean, again, if I go back to the city I'm from, Melbourne, when I was a kid, the second freeway was being built to the new airport. And amazingly, we used to go for the family walk on the freeway construction site on a Sunday, because this is way before health and safety. And And it was two lanes each way. Now, my mum lives off one end of it, and where my wife and I lived was at the just when you come off in the city. So I've used it quite a lot over the years. Well, it got expanded 20 years ago to four lanes each way. I think it's up to about six lanes each way. That's really done for peak hour in morning and afternoon when thousands of people are going into the central business district to work. Now, what are the gains we're going to make in terms of childcare, family connections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if we can come out of this and say, well, let's increase the hours of work done from home by 25%. Most employers will tell you, we were chatting about this before, that their employees, if you can make life more flexible for them, make it fit in and help them do better in terms of what they, everything else they want out of life with their families and so on, well, you'll get more productivity anyway. So I think we need to come out of this starting from the thought, I'm not trying to be Pollyannish saying we can have a vibrant economy while we're in complete lockdown, but we need to push ourselves to say, are there as many trade-offs as we think? How can we get the economy going without, undermining the tackling the pandemic and turning back some of the environmental gains? How do we keep trying to put these things together and find multiple solutions? As a regulator, I can't sit here and say we need to find ways to do that, which really is implying partly that the businesses we regulate need to think like that, without saying we'll respond to it, we'll be more flexible. You know, we'll help you think in terms of the requirements we put on you about how you can do that with more agility and so on and so forth. So it needs everyone. You can't change a system unless you have systems thinking and everyone in the system thinks from that perspective.
Thank you, Terry. No, there's some really, really important questions coming out of all of this. Thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in for this special COVID-19 Environment Law News podcast. For more information, or if you would like to discuss any of the topics raised in more detail, please contact Six Pump Court on 0207 797 8400, asking for Mark Davis, or contact Simone Davidson in LexisNexis's PSL Environment team.